Gemini North and Gemini South are two of the biggest telescopes in the world. At the National Astronomy Meeting in Preston this year, I spoke with one of the astronomers who work at the Gemini telescopes. Scott Fisher, Science Fellow at Gemini Observatory.
Gemini is it's an international collaboration. Seven countries have a part of Gemini: the U.S., the U.K., Canada, Argentina, Brazil, and Chile. All have, and Australia's in there somewhere. There's two telescopes. One is on Mauna Kea in Hawaii in the northern hemisphere, and one is on Cerro Pachón in central Chile, minus 30 in the south and plus 20 in the north.
Right.
And so we get the full sky coverage. They're 8-meter telescopes, so they're biggies. I think number 6 and 7 on the top 10 list or something like that. In general, they're very well optimized for the infrared. I mean, we feel the infrared is really one of our strengths, but we do really excellent optical science there also. And a unique thing of Gemini is that we have all of our mirrors are coated with protective silver, not aluminum. And that gives us a sort of an immediate 2-3% boost in the infrared because the reflectivity of silver is very high in the infrared.
Got a question, though, before you go on. Mm-hmm. It's always interesting to me. How do you surface a mirror 8-meter size?
It is an incredible process. Actually, at both sites, at the summit of Mauna Kea and at the summit of Cerro Pachón, we have a coating chamber right there. And it's a huge chamber, sort of 9 meters across. And through a week process it takes, the full engineering team of the observatory, it's brain surgery. You take the mirror out, physically remove the mirror from the telescope, and put it in the cell, the coating chamber.
Right.
Strip off the old coating and deposit the new coating down on it.
How often do you have to do this?
We thought that when we switched to silver, it was going to be a once a year sort of thing because just degradation of the surface and that sort of thing.
Is silver better in that sense than aluminum? Or
well, we were actually worried that it was going to be quite a bit worse.
Right.
We thought, okay, we're going to put the silver on here, but this means that once a year we're going to have to recoat. But it turns out that the coatings are holding up really well. And we've gone almost 2 years at Gemini North right now without recoating, with very little decrease in reflectivity. So we're really quite happy about that. Now, it's not pure silver. Well, it is. Excuse me. There's a layer of pure silver, but then it's overcoated with a layer of some nickel alloy. Now, these are angstrom thick coating. So
why is that? Why do you need the second coating?
I think the second coating is definitely protection.
Right.
The silver would tarnish, for example, and particularly you don't want to get water on it and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So the outer coating protects the silver quite well, evidently. It's lasting a long time.
So the Gemini telescopes are optimized, if you like, for optical and infrared work.
Indeed. I think I would say optimized for the infrared because it's not just the silver coating, but for example, we have the top end of Gemini, where the secondary mirror is very clean in the sense that there's a very thin spider vanes that hold the secondary mirror in place, and there's no metal sticks out from behind the secondary mirror. And this is all to keep the emissivity and the sort of thermal emission of the telescope suppressed as much as possible. That is what we sort of say when we think of infrared optimized. Now, optically, we have two very good instruments called GMOS, very versatile sort of workhorse instruments that do imaging, long slit spectroscopy, MOS spectroscopy, where you have many, say, 100 little slits, mm-hmm. and you can get 100 spectra at a time, and IFU, integral field units, in both of the GMOSes. So,
what is an integral field unit?
That's really quite cool. You get a very small field of view. Let's say you get a 5 arc second by 5 arc second field of view, but you get a spectrum of each pixel. So with one observation, you get sort of a 3D data cube. You get an image, mm-hmm. but at each pixel of that image, you also get a spectrum.
Right.
So if you consider, let's say you put the IFU, you observe the center of M31 mm-hmm. or something like that, what you're effectively doing is taking a spectrum of each pixel across your array. So you get 100 or 200 spectra just in one pointing.
So you get all of that wavelength information as well as an image.
As well as an image. You can reconstruct, you can use all of the collapse, all of the spectra down into a single image, or you can just pick out whatever little wavelength interval that you'd like to see. You know, if there's an emission line, hydrogen alpha, right, or something like that. And one thing we're really excited about is just now, near-infrared IFUs are coming online. We have one in the north called NIFS is the name of that. Same concept, but except now it works from 1 to 5 or 1 to 2.5 microns, mm-hmm, where you, again, can look at an object in near-infrared. You get an image, but also at each little pixel, you get a spectrum.
What sort of work are these integral field units used for?
Oh, man. Let's see. They're very broadly applicable. But two things that I know for sure, one are outflows. Right. For example, let's say you look at a young star and you know that there's an outflow. And with an instrument like NIFS, you put the integral field unit down on top of the star in the outflow, and you get a spectrum, of course, at every pixel, and you can make these beautiful velocity maps. Right. So you get this great velocity information, whereas before, you would have to take a long slit and then step the slit across the object.
Right, you have to move the telescope very, very slightly across the object.
Indeed,
you're looking
at. Sir. You're making tiny little offsets. So you may take 50 pointings of the telescope to get the exact same information that you're getting with one pointing with the IFU.
So what you get is your image from the IFU, and you think, oh, that's the region of outflow from the object. Look at the spectrum and go, well, that's how fast it's moving.
That's exactly right. This works just, and it's not just for young stars, in particular active galactic nuclei, mm-hmm, where you have the black holes and these awesome jets coming out of the AGNs, this sort of thing. And even, I think one thing that we're just going to start to do is IFU spectroscopy of planets like Jupiter.
Really?
So again, of course, you point this thing at Jupiter, and you have, let's say, 100 pixel elements across the disk. Not only are you getting an image, you're getting a spectrum of each of those elements,
right,
in one shot.
Right.
And that sort of thing is coming.
What are you going to learn from that? What are you going to learn from the sort of observation of Jupiter?
That's interesting. Now, this is getting a little deep for my understanding, but not only would you get wind speeds and things like that, but the spectra, the shape of the spectra change also. So, you know, maybe there's very strong methane absorption in one region, but methane emission, mm-hmm, in another region. And, you know, I'm sure that from line ratios, you can get ideas of temperatures and pressures and things like that.
Fantastic. You actually do some of the observations at times at Gemini. Is that right?
That's
indeed. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, that's quite cool. And this is, you know, one of the reasons why you get into astronomy in the first place. But there's a half a dozen or so science staff maybe 10 science staff at Gemini North and 10 at Gemini South. And we have a rotation set up. An observing shift is 4 nights plus a night of acclimation, particularly in the north of 4,200 meters.
So it's actually a height acclimation. You have to get used to the height of the telescope.
Oh, indeed. Gemini South is at 2,500 meters. That's not too bad. I mean, you feel the altitude there. But in the north at 4,200 meters, that's a serious effect.
What happens to you?
Yeah, let's see. But the funny thing, it affects everybody a little bit differently. But for me, the first thing I notice is I feel kind of loopy. You know, you're saying, whoa, wait a second. You know, a little swimming, a little bit. I'm headachy though. You feel real headachy. You want to pop your ears, your sinuses. Right. You feel pressure in your sinuses. And funny enough for me, my eyes get bloodshot red, just as red as you can possibly see up there. And there, you know, no long-term effects, but you just don't feel top-notch.
This is altitude sickness, isn't it?
It's essentially. I mean, when you get up to that altitude and you spend significant time there, and of course, you know, long winter nights are 12, 13 hours long, you're just suffering from mild hypoxia or altitude sickness. Now, Gemini is very good. We have to go through high altitude physicals and this sort of thing, so they keep you in top-notch shape. But it is an effect. A secondary effect is, you know, you're not your sharpest up at the summit either.
You're not on top of your game.
Indeed. You know, you stand up to go get a cup of coffee, and you get halfway to the kitchen, and you go, huh? coffee, yes, right, okay, that sort of thing. But so what we do is when we run the queue, we actually have during the day, before the night of observing, a person down at the base facility puts together what we call the nightly plan. And that's kind of a full-time job. That takes the person the full day to look at all of the programs that are available, look at the predicted weather for the night, look, you know, what's the phase of the moon and what objects are available. And then they put together a plan, which is then printed out basically at 4 o'clock. We have a meeting at four o'clock every day. You're handed the plan of the night. And your job up at the summit is to strictly just try to follow that plan.
Right.
Now, you do have to make some assessment of the data, and you're busy up there, you know. But you don't have to decide, oh, my gosh, should I do this program or this program? Oh, it's the moon's up, so maybe that one's not any good. That's done for you.
Right.
But so observing itself, well, you know, of course, the days of there is no eyepiece on Gemini, unfortunately. I'd love to look through that thing sometime, but no way to do that. Everything is – it's all CCD. It's all electronic. So you sit in the control room. It takes two people to run one of the Gemini telescopes. You have a telescope operator. That person's responsible for making sure the telescope is operating okay. They take you to the object that you ask for. They set up the adaptive optics system, and it takes them a few minutes, and they say, okay, go. And right. Then your job as the astronomer is to basically run the instruments. You run the camera. You make sure the correct filters are in, exposure times are okay, and you have to make a quick assessment of the data. Does this look like
right.
what we were expecting? Right. You know, is it, you know, if you're looking at a galaxy, you know, okay, does this look kind of what we're supposed to see? If you're looking at a star, you make sure it's a little point, not a big, long, elongated thing, that sort of thing. And that's kind of how it goes for the night.
But by and large, it's an automatic process.
It's pretty automatic in the sense that if you once you set up the instrument and you make sure everything is selected okay, you sort of hit go.
Yeah.
And you know, watch. And now with the optical instruments, you either have a love or hate relationship with them, because the optical instruments tend to have very long integrations.
Right.
So you can hit go, and 90 minutes later, the thing goes beep. Done. The infrared instruments are a little more interactive, as they often have data sets that appear every minute or two. And, you know, and you can sit there and, you know, look at them and say, oh, well, that one looks okay. Give it a little green check and do that sort of quality assessment throughout the night.
The sort of scheduling process for a telescope such as Gemini, what happens if the clouds roll in all of a sudden and you go, oh, what do we do with this guy's observations? Do we do them later? Do we dump them? What do you do? What's the decision you make?
No, this is one bit of background is that I was really against Q observing at first. I hated the idea of not going to the telescope and not seeing your data coming down the pipe and this sort of thing. But I've been converted. I think, you know, again, because of the fact that the Q is more efficient and this sort of thing. But you bring up a good point is if you're observing, and that's, you know, of course, the clouds do come in. You get a half a night sometimes. And the first thing we try to do is we look for programs, let's say, that can handle a little bit of cirrus or can handle poor seeing.
Right.
Or it's kind of a rare case, but every once in a while there's a case where there's just nothing available. Mm. And in that case, you sit and wait.
Right.
Just like, unfortunately, a classical observer would have to sit and wait for the clouds to go by also. But that doesn't happen so often because, you know, there's 100 programs in the queue. And some of them need pristine, perfect seeing, no moon, no wind. And some of them can say, oh, well, gosh, I'm looking at, you know, an eighth magnitude star or something. I can handle some clouds.
Yes.
I can handle, you know, poor seeing, that sort of thing. So the person that puts the plan together, they have to – you don't just have one plan. You know, you've got the perfect, no clouds, perfect seeing. You've got the a few clouds, perfect seeing. Lots of clouds, bad seeing plan.
Right.
And you kind of hop back and forth. I guess the way to say it is that Gemini, we take what the sky gives us. You know, we don't fight the sky in the sense where we try to do programs under iffy conditions. If the conditions change, we try to be flexible enough to change with them and, you know, perform observations that can handle those conditions.
Hmm. You mentioned just before about the adaptive optics system on the Gemini telescopes.
Indeed.
Can you explain a little bit about adaptive optics
sure.
How the Gemini system works?
No, that adaptive optics is – this is great. This is even for an astronomer that works there, this is pushing up against black magic. It's the Gemini has both telescopes have one system, which we call active optics. And that is, you know, we have this big mirror, this 8-meter mirror. It's actually only 10 centimeters thick. So it's a very, it's a meniscus mirror, it's called, and it's very thin. And that mirror rests on just over 100 pistons. Now, the mirror is thin enough that it slumps under its own weight. So as the telescope tracks an object over, that the mirror actually slumps down. And these once a minute, these pistons push on the back of the mirror to push it back into sort of a perfect optical form. That's what we call active optics, and both of the telescopes have those. And in the north, and soon coming to the south, but in the north right now, we also have an adaptive optics system. This is an instrument on the back end of the telescope, and within the instrument is a small little mirror, let's say 20 centimeters across or so, and that mirror is what we call a deformable mirror. The deformable mirror in our system, named Altair, mm-hmm. is the name of the adaptive optics system, can run at 1 kilohertz. So 1,000 times a second, you can deform that mirror. Now, so how do we use that? Mm-hmm. Well, we lock onto a star to guide the telescope, as every telescope does. Of course, you use a guide star and you guide the thing. But what we do is we send feedback. As Altair observes the star, it can measure the aberrations. And we know what a perfect star looks like.
Right.
We know what we're getting. You subtract the two and you get the residuals. Altair is smart enough and fast enough that it can calculate the residuals and then deform that deformable mirror to take out the aberrations in the star.
It's amazing you can do this in real time, fast enough.
It's unbelievable. And if you put your head next to Altair when it's running, you can actually hear that deformable mirror, a high-pitched hum of that, the actuators pushing that mirror 500 or 1,000 times a second.
That's fantastic.
So in effect, what you see is an incredible thing. You're watching on the screen, and you're setting up on the star, and you kind of see a little fuzzy blob there that's moving around the detector. And the telescope operator says, click, and turns Altair on, and the thing just, not only does it become dead still, this little core forms, and it just whoosh, tightens up. And we get, an increase in a factor of four in resolution is very common with Altair. You switch it off, you're getting 0.4 arc seconds. You switch it on, you're getting 0.1.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's incredible. You can't beat that.
1 kilohertz is a spectacular speed for something like this to run at.
It's not only is it the advent of high-speed feedback loops, the thing that really amazes me is you're correcting for the aberrations of the star that you're looking at in real time.
Yeah.
And so the feed, it's a computer, right? It's all due, Altair has a bank of computers in it, and those computers are dedicated to doing exactly that, calculating the aberrations. How do I have to deform that mirror to exactly cancel out sort of the aberrations that you're seeing? But again, coming down the pipe here, 5 years from now, we're going to scoff at something that only has 100 actuators. And you're going to talk about deformable mirrors that have a few hundred actuators, which means that you'll get a better correction because, you can do sort of a finer correction in that sense. But a kilohertz is probably about as fast as you need to go, at least for right now.
Why infrared? Why do we want to have such a big telescope in the infrared?
Yeah, it's... That's a really leading question. Now, I think the thing is that
I'm good at those.
In infrared in general is it opens up an entirely new window to the universe. It's akin to you say optical astronomy, infrared astronomy, radio astronomy, submillimeter astronomy. In the near infrared, you're sensitive to objects that are say 1,000 degrees Kelvin, 2,000 degrees Kelvin. This is perfect for studies of brown dwarfs, low-mass stars, the interstellar medium in some places, and this sort of thing. In the mid-infrared, a little bit longer wavelength. In the near-infrared, we're talking, let's say, 1 to 5 microns. And in the mid-infrared, we call from 5 to, say, 25 microns. There, you're sensitive to objects that are sort of a few hundred Kelvin. There you have things like, in the mid-infrared, it's sort of dust. Everything's about dust. Mm-hmm. You're looking for circumstellar disks, Beta Pictoris, Vega, our zodiacal light. Mm. Things like that. Cold dust and molecular clouds, you can see things like that. That's getting a little cold. That's getting out into the millimeter and radio regime. But the infrared, I would say broadly, the infrared is a new, not a new, but a different window into the universe. And if you, you know, if you look at the Orion Nebula in the optical, and then you look at the Orion Nebula in the mid-infrared, they look entirely different.
Yes.
And of course, if you want to have, if you want to really understand something, you got to use as many different angles on this as possible. Mm-hmm. And the combination of optical, near-infrared, and mid-infrared is real powerful, particularly star formation regions, you know, circumstellar disks, and this sort of thing. So it's a complement to the optical.
Sure. Is Gemini the best pair of telescopes to observe with infrared?
Oh, man, you're going to get me in trouble here. If not, we're right close to the top, I'll tell you. Now, I think there are some things that Gemini can do that were really the best. And one of them is the mid-infrared. And I think the reason is because of the silver coatings. That helps a lot. The very clean thermal structure of the telescope are very good. The sights are good. Mauna Kea is in a very, very good site for the mid-infrared. And we have very good instruments, one that was built right here in the UK, as a matter of fact, named Michelle, and one that was built at the University of Florida named T-Rex. And those are the two instruments on the north and the south. And those are hard to beat right now. Well, I was going to say we're very proud to say that the two most sensitive detections ever made from the ground were made from Gemini North and Gemini South. Now, again, Spitzer up in space, that's a completely different regime. Spitzer's 1,000 times more sensitive than we are, just because they don't have to look through the atmosphere. But on the other hand, I can get you 10 times better spatial resolution than Spitzer can. So it's a complementary sort of thing. But from the ground right now, Gemini is very hard to beat in the mid-infrared. In the near-infrared, we're good. We're certainly as good as Subaru, for example, or Keck, which we can see, or the VLT in some sense, I think. The VLT has a very strong adaptive optics program. And I think they're close. It's probably between them and Keck being right at the top, but we're right on their heels there. And in the optical, I would say we're as good as everybody else. Our GMOS matches very well with some of the other instruments at the big 8 to 10 meter class telescopes.
Fantastic.
Right on.
What's your research topic yourself? What are you interested in?
Yeah, I did my PhD thesis on circumstellar disks. Right. I was a mid-infrared guy. Mm-hmm. I helped build an instrument while I was in school. And looking for dust disks around stars that are similar to the sun, mm-hmm. or a little bit heavier than the sun, but Vega, Beta Pictoris, things like this, an idea where you're really looking down into sort of what we consider planetary nurseries.
Right.
These are stars that are like the sun but much younger, and they're the dust that the planets like the Earth formed out of was still dust back at that time. And one of the things we're kind of proud of is, you know, we've seen structures in some of these disks that seem to imply that there are warps and gaps and rings and things like that. True signposts for planets just forming right now. And so that's what I concentrate on the most.
So you can actually see rings in these dust disks.
Oh, indeed. Some of the best resolved ones are many arc seconds across.
Hmm.
Now, with Gemini, with an 8-meter telescope, our spatial resolution in the mid-infrared is about one-third of an arc second, 0.3, 0.4 arc seconds. So when you have a disk that's, say, 10 arc seconds across, well, you're resolving. You can resolve structure down in there. And we've seen some pretty intriguing things that look like gaps. And you think, well, how do you get a gap in a disk? Well, certainly you have something orbiting around the star, clearing out a gap, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Indirect evidence. Now, you know, we haven't seen a bright spot in there yet, but we're looking.
Is it possible, though, for Gemini to see the actual planet themselves?
I think we're getting close, mate. As a matter of fact, we have two programs right now that are actively looking for planets, for extrasolar, and not just indirect evidence, you know, like the reflex motion, the Doppler shift planets, which we call, but a true picture. And there's a big race. All the biggies.
Sure.
All the biggies right now. We got a race, and we're running as hard as anybody else to try to get it. And we have certainly at least as good a chance, as I would say, as the other big telescopes. Again, just because we feel that we're real strong in the infrared, and that's where it's going to happen first.
Will it be through the sensitivity of Gemini or through the spatial resolution of Gemini that you'll be able to see these planets directly, or a combination?
No, that's a good question. I mean, I think that It's a combination. I mean, it's very hard to separate these things, but I think image quality and sensitivity, the combination of those two factors, give us a good shot. Now, the adaptive optics on VLT and Keck, they give them a little bit of leg up. So we all have our strengths, and that's why it's such a close race. We're within one or two strides of each other, I think, right now in the race to image the first extrasolar planet.
Oh, that's exciting times.
Yeah, it's pretty neat, though. I mean, to even think about this, you know, my thesis advisor, you know, oh, well, he weren't even thinking about this back in the 70s sort of thing. Yeah. So that's pretty cool.
What brings you to Preston for the NAM?
For the NAM, I'm my official title is I'm the outreach scientist for Gemini. So in this particular case, I don't have science to present, but I'm here representing Gemini as not just a PR person, but I guess in some sense a PR person in this case. You know, I want to talk to people at the meeting if they have questions. You know, again, there's this kind of weird thing about Gemini is since we run the queue so much, people don't come to visit us so much. And maybe, you know, it's hard to get the word out to the community. And listen, the UK is a 25% partner of Gemini. They are a major partner in our telescopes. Mm-hmm. And we want to make sure that the UK community realizes what we can do for them. And so we're here to sort of press the flesh and try to get the word out about what we're doing there.
Fantastic. Thank you very much indeed for taking the time to
talk
to us.
Nice to talk to you, buddy.
Brilliant.